Exodus chapter 40, and starting reading from verse 33. Just to give you a bit of an idea, that whole bit there between where Christina finished reading and this part in Exodus chapter 40, basically they've been carrying out God's instructions exactly as he has given them and built the tabernacle. And this is what's happened. Right, it doesn't feel right to kind of finish a book like Exodus without reading right to the end of the book, does it? So let's fulfill all righteousness and do that in the next couple of minutes. Let me read chapter 40, verse 33. Then Moses set up the courtyard around the tabernacle and altar and put up the curtain at the entrance to the courtyard. And so Moses finished the work. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. In all the travels of the Israelites, whenever the cloud lifted from above the tabernacle, they would set out. But if the cloud did not lift, they did not set out until the day it lifted. So the cloud of the Lord was over the tabernacle by day, and fire was in the cloud by night, in the sight of all the Israelites during all their travels. And there ends Exodus. I want to start this morning, though, by asking you a quick question. From that reading, Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled upon it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Now, what do you reckon is happening there? What do you reckon that means? Especially that last phrase there, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Now, hopefully you remember that the tabernacle is basically a tent. If you haven't been here the last few weeks, that's what it is. It's a tent. It's a tent built for Yahweh, the God of Israel, to live in amongst his people Israel. And a couple of Sundays ago, we looked in detail, in some detail, that God gave to Moses on how this tabernacle was to be built. And all up, the courtyard and everything, the actual tent itself, the tabernacle was about 50 metres by about 25 metres, which means it's actually smaller than this church building and the property that we're on. So, how on earth, in verse 35... How on earth does verse 35 work? What do you think is happening when God's glory filled this little tabernacle? Because the Psalms tell us that the glory of God is even above the heavens. So in what sense does the glory of the true and living God go into this little tent? What sort of image are we supposed to have in our minds here? Well, one image I've got is of this really, really huge, muscly guy, a bit like me, Arnold Schwarzenegger, say, right? That's who I'd get to cast if we're my own biopic. It kind of trying to squeeze into this size 3-0, and I make it size 5-0 baby suit, all right, that we're going to be having in 8 or 9 months' time. Not weeks, sorry. Us as a church. Let me just start all that again. Wow, there's something in the water. There's something in my brain. I don't know what it is. All right, get your brains off that. All right, or like the genie, right, in Aladdin. All right, remember that bit? Phenomenal cosmic power in itty-bitty living space. All right, he's got this, or else I've got this other image in my head. Remember last week we talked about the Niagara Falls in America. Remember how I told you there's 2.4 million litres of water a second going over the edge. And I've got this picture of me standing there with a teacup trying to fit all that water in this little pathetic little container. It's kind of ridiculous, isn't it? How do you fit the God of the universe into this little tent? What sort of image are you meant to have here of the glory of Yahweh in a little tent? Physically, or we're told, it seems that this cloud settles over the tabernacle. And that's because ever since the Exodus itself, when God saved Israel out of Egypt, his presence, it's been indicated, it's been symbolized by this cloud. But I want us this morning to look beyond what's actually seen by the people and think theologically about this. Right? What are we being told about God when we read phrases like, the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle? Because I think we'll actually see some really important things as we close out the book of Exodus for us, and we'll see some really important things about Jesus. But firstly, to this phrase, the glory of God. All right, let's just kind of put aside the whole tabernacle thing for just a moment. All right, what do we even mean by this phrase, the glory of God? Well, the book of Exodus is actually quite helpful here. God's glory, funnily enough, is not actually mentioned in the book before, in the book of Genesis, which is kind of a bit funny. It's a bit surprising, isn't it, given this grand scope that we have, especially at the beginning of the book of Genesis, and the things that you see God do there. I mean, creation at the beginning of Genesis, and that really is the showcase of God's power, his size, his scale, this phenomenal cosmic creative might that he has, his awesome ability to do things with just a word. And yet God's glory, well, it's nowhere seen. It's not actually mentioned there in Genesis at all. It never actually pops up until you reach the book that we've been in for the last 7 weeks, the book of Exodus. And in Exodus, his glory is specifically mentioned in only a few places, four key events before we even get to the very end, before we get to this point here. Have a look with me. There's the mention of God's glory when he saved his people, Israel, through the Red Sea. All right, and then there's the mention of God's glory when he provides them with food in the desert. And then there's another mention of God's glory when he descends on Mount Sinai and speaks to Israel. And maybe the most important one, maybe most importantly, you get this mention of God's glory when he responds to that golden calf debacle that we looked at last week. Remember last week? Remember that stunningly stupid act of mistake that they make? After all that God has done for them, Israel turns their back on him and bows down and worships an idol. Remember that? And last week, we were just struck by how terribly offensive that was to God, a God who is jealous in the right way. And yet, despite how offensive that was, despite the fact that it did push God to the very brink of his mercy, what you discover is that God still graciously decides to stick with Israel. Rather than wipe him off the face of the earth as punishment, which he's got every right to do, instead of that, he decides he's going to persist with them. That it's in response to that wonderfully gracious decision for God to stick with Israel that Moses, in our first Bible reading that Christina read for us before, rather daringly asked God. Moses asks him straight out, Yahweh, show me your glory. And God's response to that, when Moses asks, Yahweh, show me your glory, get this, God's response is, I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, Yahweh, in your presence. I'll have mercy on whom I'll have mercy, and I'll have compassion on whom I'll have compassion. Chapter 33, verse 19 in our readings there. Now, bear with me here. There's an important link. There's a really important link here. Moses asks God to see his glory. But what does God say he's going to show him? God says he's going to show him his goodness. His goodness is going to pass in front of him. And then he goes on to speak about his mercy and compassion. In other words, according to God, his glory is not so much his power as his goodness. The glory of God is not so much about how strong he is. It's actually about how loving he is, which makes perfect sense of why we've seen God's glory mentioned in all those previous parts of the book. So let's go back again over those four places. God's glory was mentioned when he parted the Red Sea, because that's exactly when his goodness was on view, saving Israel out of faithfulness to his word, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God's glory was mentioned when Israel complained about not having enough food, and that's exactly when his goodness was on view, because he puts up with them. He would put up with their whinging and be good enough to feed them. God's glory was on view at Mount Sinai when his goodness was on display, that he would condescend to come down to a mountain to speak with his people so that they would hear his voice, that they would know how to respond to him properly, rightly, in thankful obedience. And here, after the golden calf mistake, God's glory gets a mention again because, of course, his goodness is on view again, that he could find it in his heart to forgive them after the astonishingly offensive thing that they've done. Friends, can you see what Exodus is saying about the glory of God? It's not about his power. It's not about his strength. It's not about his might, all of which he's got plenty of. Hey, let me get that straight. But in Exodus, when God's glory is talked about, it's about his love. It's about his mercy. It's about his faithfulness. And you see, with that in mind, God filling the tabernacle with his glory, it's actually a really illuminating statement to make. Because more than anything, what that image was meant to have, what we're meant to have in our brains as we read a phrase like that, isn't, gee, I wonder what that might look like. Or gee, I wonder what it would sound like. What sort of special effects would come along with God's presence, God's glory? Maybe a really kind of low frequency thumb, as God's kind of glory. No. The wow factor of when God filled the tabernacle, the really glorious thing, is that he would even be bothered doing it. That he, the God of all the universe, would bring himself to dwell in a tabernacle, in a tent, amongst Israel, especially after the shoddy way that they've been treating him. That's where God's glory is. Eula is a young teenage patient at Lady Salento's Children's Hospital. We actually seen her across the corridor every now and then. And one day she was told, when she was having her hospital stay there, that she was in for a surprise. That some people, probably a Make-A-Wish Foundation or someone like that, had brought in a camera crew, and that she was going to have a bit of a surprise. She confessed to the camera that, maybe it's a sports person. You know, maybe it's kind of one of the kind of famous people that get around. From Good Morning. I don't even know what the morning shows are anymore. But is Good Morning Australia one of them? No? Okay, sorry. She thought might be a really, really nasty surprise, like one of those things that, a room full of spiders, she reckoned, and she hates spiders. So imagine her surprise when they took her for a walk around the corridors of the hospital, and she bumped into, no less than, Johnny Depp, better known as Captain Jack Sparrow to her and her generation of people, I think. Here was one of the biggest movie stars in the world, notoriously shy in front of cameras when he's not on screen, right here before her eyes, right here in Brisbane, of all places in the world, right? And he's dropped in just to see her. And she said, apparently afterwards, Courier Mail interviewed her, she said, apparently it was all his idea. All right, that just makes me love him even more. That he's just like a big kid. I wish he'd come back, she says. He was just so cool. How impressive was it that Johnny Depp, Captain Jack Sparrow, would come and visit a sick kid, after a long day on set? Right? How much more impressive is it that Yahweh would not just come to pay a visit upon Israel, that he would come to live amongst them. And remember the story of Exodus here. This isn't some nice teenager who's gone through a lot, right? Who's giddy with excitement to be with him. Remember what it says in Exodus here. This is a stiff-necked people who have a track record of ignoring Yahweh and whinging at him and offending him. I mean, this is the God of the entire universe. This is the maker of the heavens and the earth. This is the owner and sustainer of every single thing you can see. And these ingrates have been treating him as if he was dirt. And yet, Yahweh comes to the tabernacle. It is a stunning act of grace, which is precisely why we're told, not that his splendor filled the tabernacle, Not that his majesty filled the tabernacle, not that his phenomenal cosmic powers filled the tabernacle, but his glory filled the tabernacle. For God's glory is about his loving, compassionate nature. It's not at all about a big God squeezing into a little tent. It's about a loving God unbelievably coming to live amongst a people who just don't deserve him. No wonder in our first passage read out for us, this gets said as his glory goes past Moses. Chapter 34, verses 6 and 7. The Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands, or probably a better translation, thousands of generations, and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sins of the parents to the third and fourth generation. See, at that same glorious compassion, grace, love, faithfulness, mercy, justice, that same glory is shown at the end of the book when God's presence graciously fills the tabernacle, when God's presence graciously comes to dwell amongst his people. And well, that makes for a great ending, doesn't it, to the book of Exodus. Trouble is, that's not the happily ever after that we're looking for. Trouble is, that's not the ending to the Old Testament. You may have noticed there that there's a few more books to the Old Testament after Exodus 35, as a matter of fact. And the sad thing is that a lot of it isn't pretty, especially some of it to do with God's glory. But it is interesting for us, though, what we learn as we trace through Israel's story after the Exodus. Basically, what happens is after Israel settles into the Promised Land, they erect a temple in Jerusalem. The tabernacle was the tent that was always meant to be temporary, all right? So Solomon builds this temple for God. And what you discover is exactly the same thing happens to the temple as what happens to the tabernacle. On the official opening of the temple, we're reading 1 Kings chapter 8 there, that when the priests withdrew from the holy place, the cloud filled the temple of the Lord, and the priests could not perform their service because of the cloud, because the glory of the Lord had filled this temple. It's exactly a rerun of what we just heard with the tabernacle. Again, it's a measure of God's goodness that he would be prepared to live amongst Israel in the Promised Land. And that's what Solomon basically says in his prayer of dedication. He says to God, it's a lot more wordier than this, please take the time to read it, but basically says, I can't believe you're going to live amongst us, God. I can't believe you're going to come and dwell in this temple that I've just built for you. I can't believe that you're going to give us forgiveness from this place. I don't know how you're going to do it, but I'm really glad you're going to. Right, so it's all about God's goodness again there with the temple. Sadly, though, as the years go by, things go pear-shaped for Israel. Despite God's goodness, they keep rehashing the same sin of the golden calf. They keep chasing after other gods. They keep bowing down to idols. They push Yahweh off the center of their world. And year after year after year after year after years of warning them, God eventually has had enough. And so what happens is the prophet Ezekiel has this vision all about God's glory. And in this vision, he sees God's glory not moving into the temple. He actually sees God's glory moving up and out of the temple to disappear over the horizon. God has left the building. And it's a devastating vision there that Ezekiel has, because for Israel, it's saying that God's goodness has left them. His grace has had enough. His mercy has been pushed over the brink. And so it is in history we find that they are punished, finally. Israel are thrown out of the Promised Land. Solomon's temple is destroyed. Jerusalem is flattened. We went through that in Isaiah about this time last year. Things between Israel and God were never to be the same again. In fact, even though Israel eventually get back into the Promised Land and they actually rebuild another temple, right, this little dinky one there, you see it's all kind of still open, you know, open air and hasn't been quite finished yet. But it's really telling that even when it's finished, we were never told in the Old Testament that God's glory re-enters the temple. Or all this stuff about it filling the tabernacle, all the stuff about it filling Solomon's temple, it's never mentioned again for this new one that they rebuild. And so the Old Testament virtually finishes with a whimper. Because God's glory, the full weight of his goodness and mercy, is not with them anymore the way it used to be. And this is where Jesus comes in. Take a look at this with me. It comes from John chapter 1, verse 14. I've got it up on the slides there. Try and hear it afresh as I read it out. With all the background in mind about the tabernacle and God's glory. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Actually, let me read it a little bit more literally. The Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Do you see that? Tabernacled among us. Do you see how all those threads in the Old Testament, in the tabernacle and the temple and God's glory and his grace dwelling there, do you see how they all converge in that one verse on Jesus? The glory is back, dwelling on earth again. God's goodness is back. His grace has returned, only now it's even better than before. Because in Jesus, God's glory is taken to this whole new level. In Jesus, God's goodness is taken to a ridiculously high level. For God has not come as a cloud in a tent. He has come in flesh and blood. Can you get your head around that? Can you wrap your brains around that fact? God has become a mammal, a human being, starting off as a baby. God's being pushed out of a womb of a teenage girl in a stable. All right, God will be passed around and poked and pushed, and knowing Middle Eastern kind of culture, having his cheek squeezed at the family get-togethers. God is going to be growing up in the backwaters of this enemy-occupied territory there in Galilee, where there's no electricity, there's no mod cons, and God is going to be growing up to be continually misunderstood, even by his friends, and he's going to be continually rejected, even by his family, who think that he's gone mad. And all this time, there's going to be complete strangers coming up to him, asking him to do favors for them. And yet, step by step, he will give, and he will serve, and he will give, and he will serve, and he will give, and he will serve, and he will give till there's nothing left to give. When he's nailed on that cross, and in darkness, and in loneliness, and in agony, naked and exposed to the elements, he will die a death that we deserve. Can you begin to imagine, can you begin to understand how much you must matter to God for him to do that? And can you begin to see how glorious he is? How good he is. And friends, here at the end of the book, let me just pull some threads together by making this obvious point. It's all about Jesus. It's all been about Jesus every week, week in and week out. We started today thinking about the glory of God in the tabernacle. That was 1200 BC. And we end up seeing that that's only just an appetizer, right? That was just the warm-up act for what was to follow, when God's glory become a man and eventually walk on this earth and breathe this air that we breathe and die our death for us. Is this sounding familiar? This has been the pattern we've seen week in and week out. I've only got one sermon to preach to you. It's been Jesus every week, if you haven't gotten that. Whether it's the glory of God this week, or the failure of the law to bring obedience, or the tabernacle, the priest, or the atoning sacrifice, week in and week out, we've been seeing that it's all getting us ready for Jesus. Every single thing along the way, it's all being fulfilled ultimately in the coming of God's own Son. The one who comes as the answer to all the problems Exodus throws up to us. It's all been pointing us to the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. And I'm wondering if that's a pretty good thing to bear in mind as we finish Exodus. First, just to take stock, to kind of just feel the weight of the fact that everything in the Bible, not just Exodus, everything in the Bible leads us to Jesus in God's thinking, in God's purposes. See, God's thinking and his plans, they're actually all about Jesus as well. That's why the Bible's written this way. And as far as God's concerned, the really important stuff in our lives, the really important stuff in life, full stop, is the stuff about Jesus. All of our other achievements, all of our other hopes and aspirations, that they need to take a number and line up behind him. Because as far as God's concerned, that little kids' church class, or the little RE class that you've been teaching, that the breakfast club that you've been served at the state school, the Cassiary State School, that you've been serving there, serving kids with breakfast in the name of Jesus, that's actually being far more important than your early retirement or the fact that you've paid off your house. And that growth group that you've been faithfully getting along to, that women's conference you've busted your gut to free yourself up for, that's actually far more important from God's perspective than your job satisfaction or that promotion that you've just gotten. And your personal Bible reading and your prayer life, that from God's perspective is actually far more constructive than the academic study or the personal development courses that you went along to. Your kids getting to know Jesus, that's actually far more important than how they went in school or how they went in music or sport. You're working hard at obedience to Jesus, that's actually far more crucial than how much weight you've lost or how your physical fitness is going. You do see that, don't you? Your life this past 6 months, do they reflect that priority? What about the next 6 months? How are your plans going for that? See, if Jesus is at the heart of all God's plans, and we've been seeing that week in and week out in Exodus, don't you reckon Jesus ought to be at the heart of our plans? That'll be a good thing to bear in mind, wouldn't it? As we take to plan the rest of our year, the rest of our lives. Because as far as God's concerned, it's all leading into Jesus. He is the one who matters. Friends, for the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us, tabernacled among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. And if that isn't worth putting at the center of your life, then I reckon nothing is.